community events calendar. The posting is free, and it takes only a couple of minutes to complete the online form. Then we'll keep your announcement posted until your event is over. Just log on to kpft.org and click on the link called Community Calendar and share your event with all of us. Another public service from your community radio station, KPFT Houston.
KPFT members are part owners of 90.1 FM. You've had a vested interest in Pacifica Radio for decades.
Now, Pacifica plans to democratically elect a new board of directors.
Fundación Radio Pacifica funciona de una manera democrática.
We're looking to the community to find hardworking people to run for the local station board. The KPFT Elections Committee is seeking qualified candidates with a diverse cultural, racial background, sexual orientation, and economic circumstances.
KPFT wants to become the model of inclusion on Houston's FM radio dial.
If you'd like to run for election or join the elections committee, please contact Dennis Fetters at 713-526-4000.
Yeah, email bheje elections@kpft.org.
This is Pacifica Radio.
This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. It's 57 degrees here in Houston, and it is a non-fun driving show. So we asked you if you have given to KPFT, if you pledged to please fulfill that, especially if you did it for this show. Coming up on this show, the second hour, of course, we're going to be doing Queer Music Heritage, which looks like it's going to be a great segment this week, this month. But in the first hour, we're going to be talking to Anise Parker, who is running for city controller after working 6 years on city council. And that's coming up, the election's coming up in a very short time. In fact, you can already vote now. But first, we go to London for the BBC News, live from London.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The American Secretary of State, Colin Powell, has appealed to international aid agencies not to pull out of Iraq. He's speaking after the latest series of attacks which killed more than 30 people in the capital, Baghdad. One of the organizations targeted, the International Committee of the Red Cross, said it's reviewing its operations in Iraq. From Washington, Michael Buchanan reports.
Colin Powell describes the attacks in Baghdad as a bad 24 hours. He says he's concerned that the Red Cross and other NGOs are considering scaling back their operations in Iraq in the wake of the killings. Their work is needed, says Mr. Powell, and if they are driven out, then the terrorists win. The Secretary of State went on to urge the groups to work closely with the US military, to not necessarily give them direct protection, he says, but to provide them with a safer environment in which to work. But, reiterating what President Bush had said earlier, Mr. Powell says the U.S. will continue with its reconstruction efforts.
A senior American commander in northern Iraq has said only a small minority of the forces opposing his troops are foreign fighters. Speaking in a video link-up with the Pentagon, Major General Raymond Odierno said the majority, 95%, were Saddam Hussein loyalists, although he did not believe that the former Iraqi leader was himself directing the attacks. The BBC Pentagon correspondent says the Bush administration has been making much of its concerns about the influx of foreign fighters into Iraq. A new United Nations report on the Democratic Republic of Congo says the illegal exploitation of minerals remains inextricably linked to the continuing conflict in the country. In a confidential section of the report, given only to the 15 Security Council members, the independent authors accuse Rwanda, Uganda, and elements of the Kinshasa government itself of helping perpetuate the fighting by backing militia groups. The report warns that without a strong central democratically elected government, the plundering of resources will continue and fuel the conflict. President Bush has declared a disaster area in Southern California, where wildfires have killed at least 13 people and forced the evacuation of tens of thousands of others. Thousands of firefighters are tackling 10 separate major wildfires in an area stretching from the Mexican border to the suburbs of Los Angeles. Mr. Bush has pledged government help and said that investigators from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, will be sent there.
The federal government will provide all resources necessary at the request of the state to work and fight these fires. FEMA Director Brown is on his way to California now. He'll give us an assessment. And we want to help put them out. I mean, this is a devastating fire, and it's a dangerous fire, and we're prepared to help in any way we can.
Nearly 900 homes have been destroyed, and some estimates say insurance claims could reach $100 billion. You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. The first black mayor of a major American city, Walter Washington, has died at the age of 88. He became the first elected mayor of the country's capital in 1974, although he served unelected before that. Layla Hayes reports.
In 1967, President Johnson appointed Washington mayor of the country's capital, a city with a majority black population. Just 6 months later, he faced his first major test when the black rights activist Martin Luther King was killed, setting off days of riots that devastated the city. During the riots, the mayor reassured residents through radio and television statements and resisted demands by some members of Congress the looters be shot. Washington's non-violent treatment of the protesters saw him credited with preventing major riots in the District of Columbia.
New research suggests that smoking increases someone's chances of developing multiple sclerosis. A study involving more than 22,000 people in Norway found that men who smoked were nearly three times as likely to develop the disease as non-smokers. The risk for women smokers was more than 1.5 times higher than for non-smokers. Scientists hope the study will help them understand more about the causes of multiple sclerosis, a disease in which the protective covering surrounding nerve fibers in the central nervous system is destroyed. A Russian Soyuz spacecraft carrying three astronauts from the International Space Station is heading back to Earth. The spacecraft is expected to arrive in the steppes of Kazakhstan shortly. Two of the astronauts have spent the last 6 months on board the space station. The third arrived last week on a different capsule. BBC News.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Falinski.
And I'm Joan Devlin.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
Well, normally we go right into, we do a little chit-chatting, then we go right into This Way Out and News Wrap, but unfortunately it's, I guess, the monthly cycle when they forget to record it here at the station. And we'll try to get that fixed, or try to, you know, complain a little bit to get that fixed, so that isn't a problem.
Jack, complain?
We'll get you the best of it, though, and bring it next week.
Yes, but if you would like to listen to This Way Out, you can listen to it online probably about Wednesday. They post
Tuesday or Wednesday they upload it.
ThisWayOut.org, and you can actually listen to it streaming audio, real audio, which is great. You have a chance to listen to it. So I apologize that we don't have it, but it was beyond our control. A couple things going up. J.D., how was the Women's Festival?
It was very nice, but it was different than what they expected because it rained all day Saturday. They finally gave it up about 3:30 or 4 o'clock and moved the event to Chances, which was, it worked pretty well. It was a different event, of course, than an outdoor venue. And, of course, the people that had booth setups, you know, selling crafts and things like that, they probably took a beating. But the music was very good. The crowd seemed to be into it. It lasted into the night.
Well, it's unfortunate because they've had such a good success in the past with the weather, and I guess this year it just sort of caught up to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe next year they'll get their indoor-outdoor venue back, and they won't have to worry so much about the weather.
It was a good venue at Jones Plaza, I think, that it worked there, but you just couldn't really judge from Saturday.
Well, with us now is Anise Parker, who has successfully served almost three terms as a at-large city council person. And from all the reviews, including the Chronicle, it's been a very successful run. Of course, the city does have some problems. And you're going to be shifting from dealing with some of these problems to actually dealing with money, which is probably one of the toughest jobs in the city.
I'm looking forward to the opportunity. Now, you need to point out that I am term limited and I cannot run for re-election to my city council seat. So I had to decide what I wanted to do next. And Controller's office is an open seat. Sylvia Garcia was the city controller. She was elected to the commissioner's court, and we appointed someone who is not running, so it's an open shot. It actually plays to my strengths. I was in a numbers crunching job before I came into city government, so I have the numbers background, and now I have the policy background for my term on council.
You're the only one that has that, right?
No, this is a very strong field in the controller's race. There are six of us running. I'm the only woman in the race, so I'm easy to pick out on the ballot. But I think everybody in the race is qualified for the position. There are three running from within city government. In addition to me, there are two other city council members, and then there are three outsiders and accountants.
What are some of the different challenges that you're going to be dealing with as opposed to city council?
Well, the sad part is that the controller does not have a vote. And so the grand policy debates and the quality of life issues, the neighborhood issues that I've been working on, I can't affect any longer. But the controller is a critical element in city government. The controller certifies the budget. The controller pays the bills. The controller makes sure that money is available for the services. And the controller is the chief financial officer. The controller audits city government.
Does the controller have any leverage on where the money goes, like what banks or what percentage rate it can get if it's in, you know, being held somewhere?
Certainly. The controller has a lot of influence.
All in Ann Richards, as she is state treasurer?
Very similar. More like we've sort of abolished the state treasurer's job and rolled a lot of it under the state comptroller. It's similar to what Carol Keaton Strayhorn does at the state level. You're the chief financial officer. You invest the state's money. But you have an audit function over city departments. And I believe that if you really want to have police protection in parks and libraries and the things that we all think are important in the city, you need a controller who can make sure that there's not waste or fraud in city government so that money's available.
But isn't there always a different opinion that the mayor has on how much money is left to spend versus what the controller believes?
I don't know if there's always a debate, but
it seems like
that's an element. Well, the controller's office was created to be a counterweight to the strongest mayor in the country. And there's a change in the city charter I'd like to see. Actually, there are two changes in the city charter I'd like to see, but one would require that council and the mayor use the controller's revenue estimate. That's what we do at the state level. The state controller says, this is how much money you have to spend, go spend it. At the city level, the mayor determines how much he thinks he's got to spend. The controller does an independent revenue estimate but cannot compel anybody to use it. You're just simply a sounding board you have a watchdog function, but in terms of the budget, all you can do is advise. That's one change I'd like to see, to force council and mayor to use that. Another is that the controller under the charter does financial audits, and I think the controller ought to have performance audit ability. Think what it would have meant had the controller been able to go in and do a performance audit of the crime lab.
Yes.
Instead of a petty cash audit, mm-hmm. for example.
Mm-hmm.
To really be able to objectively and independently analyze that department, since the controller doesn't have a vote, doesn't have authority over that department, and right now we leave performance audits to the mayor. So you're auditing yourself.
Right. Well, you know, it was interesting. There was just recently a vote to lower the taxes. And, you know, it seemed like you were one of the only ones at the beginning that was talking against that, you and the mayor. And, you know, already we were under such a tight budget and they were going to lower the taxes, which it meant it would have been worse.
We were voting on whether to lower the tax rate. And the city of Houston has actually lowered the tax rate. In the year 2000, we lowered the tax rate by 1 cent per $100 valuation, and I was one of the council members who made the motion to do that at that time. It was a compromise effort to prevent a larger rollback, but it made economic sense to do it then. If you look at what's happening in the state and all the cities, and even in the national government, is what, $800 billion in deficit. The state had a $10 billion deficit, billion with a B. And the city is looking at a $10 million deficit on the good side. It could be as bad as $27 to $50 million. And it just seemed like a very inappropriate time to roll back the tax rate when we're the only taxing entity in the area that's done any kind of tax relief at all, and we're facing a revenue shortfall. I guess I should say I misspoke, a budget deficit. We don't do deficit spending. They do it in the federal level, but at the state level and the local level, we always have a balanced budget.
You know, there's a whole bunch of interesting things is that it seems like every state and city is having problems with money. And the first thing when a politician's going to run from the outside, he said, well, we're just going to make it more efficient.
There are always efficiencies. The city, depending on how you look at it, we either have a $1.4 billion annual budget or a $2.4 billion annual budget, but that extra $1 billion is capital projects, and so it's not money that's available to pick up your garbage with. It's we borrow that money, and it's like the mortgage on your house. We have to make payments on it. But a $1.4 billion, 25% of that comes from sales taxes. The other comes from property taxes, and a little bit from fines and fees. But where we've had a hard time budgeting is the sales tax number. And well, it's just an inexact science. Every retailer in America would like to know how much they're going to sell at Christmas time. Mm-hmm. And we're doing the same thing. We're trying to guess what they're going to sell so we know what our sales tax is going to be. And when we have the revenue come in less than we expected, then we have to cut expenses. And directly to your question about, you know, waste, cutting waste, we have had a declining economy here in the area for a couple of years now. We have... We went from 23,000 city employees to 21,000 city employees. We have cut back on library hours and park hours. We have squeezed the efficiencies out of every place that we could think to squeeze. And yes, I mean, we could save a few thousand dollars here and a few thousand dollars there, and it adds up. But two-thirds of our budget is police and fire. And if you add public works in, that's roads and bridges and streetlights and so forth, that's 75% of the budget. And for the first couple of years, we tried to squeeze all the savings we could out of the 25% remaining. We said, you know, we can't cut police, we can't cut fire. Well, look at the budget another way. And I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers out there. 77% of the budget is salaries. So ultimately, when you say, oh, we're going to squeeze the waste and fraud out and we're going to come in and clean up, if 77% of our budget is salaries, if you want to really save money in the city, you have to lay people off. You have to stop providing a service. And most of those employees are police and fire, garbage, which is solid waste, and then of course public works. We have felt that we can't do that, so again we go back to, well, let's cut library hours, let's cut park hours. And then you end up with a city that no one wants to live in.
Right, and then that idea of furloughing people one day out of 2 weeks or something like that, that on the morale alone would probably decrease efficiency or any
yes.
savings.
Now, we did, I opposed it, but council passed a furlough for our highest paid city employees, forcing a five-day furlough for them. But the bulk of our city employees, the municipal employees, the civilian employees rather than police and fire, tend to be paid below their peers in the private sector. And if you add a furlough on top of that, it can be really painful.
As your experience in city council, I mean, there's a number of things that are going on. Of course, right now, the big talk about is rail and traffic and getting around. And some people just think the idea is just adding more lanes all the time, which Houston has done in the past. And, you know, putting a rail line down Main is probably going to help, but it certainly isn't the answer. And even extending the rail another 70 miles is not going to be the answer either. But where do we go? I mean, I guess we have to start somewhere.
Well, you could have magically put in the best, most comprehensive rail system in the country, and we'd still have congested freeways, and we'd still have traffic. There are going to be a million more people here in the next 10 years or so. It's a very rapidly growing area. it's about having as wide an option of wide an array of choices as you possibly can. And there are folks who are opposed to it. I support the rail plan. I wish we were voting on the full plan, because I think we need to commit to it.
Well, in the mid-'80s, I think we had that option, but it didn't sort of went down the drain.
We made Heavy Rail with Kathy Whitmire. Well, on Monorail with Kathy Whitmire, and then we elected Bob Lanier, and he ran on a platform to do away with it. But building more freeways isn't the answer. Having options in transportation. Yes, we have to keep building freeways, but you know they have that, 24 lanes that they're proposing on the Katy Freeway. And if you read the engineering reports, their projection is that it will be at capacity by the time it's built.
Not to mention what it's going to do to it before it's built.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And expanding freeways, putting in more lanes, it destroys businesses, it destroys homes. You're laying more cement out there. You have to deal with flooding issues, more cars, more pollution. Rail isn't going to solve anything, but it's an option that a lot of people will use, and they'll use it effectively. It will move a certain number of people, and it will drive infill development, and it'll get people out of their cars, and it will provide a service to folks who don't have access to the forms of transportation. And I would remind everybody that what we're voting on, rail is a piece of a much larger plan. They've got more efficient buses, more extensive bus service, and so forth.
Quality of life. I mean, that's not always looked at in Houston as, you know, Houston having a quality of life. And all of a sudden, now that the Super Bowl is going to come here in January, there's all this rush to make the city look clean. It's like, where was that thought beforehand? And the parks.
Oh, we do that year round now.
It's all sports driven. The Olympics, the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, quality of life includes better air and parks, and you know, place being able to walk on sidewalks. That's a tough thing to do here in Houston.
I would disagree. When you think about it, Houston has great weather 10 months out of the year. I mean, July and August, it can be pretty brutal here, and people give up on the sidewalk cafes. And for a week or two in the winter, you probably want to stay indoors, but really we're a year-round city, and we have to there are accommodations that we make for the heat and sometimes for the mosquitoes, but we're increasingly attracting folks who want to come here for the economy, want to come here for jobs, want to come here because there's a very, very low cost of living plus all big city amenities. And we have to make sure that we have an outdoor environment and a quote-unquote quality of life that makes us an attractive place for workers, the creative class.
If anybody hasn't discovered the T.C. Jester bike path, it is fabulous. It is like one of the best I've seen anywhere in the country. That's a great project. Unfortunately, I wish it was longer and, you know, went further.
We've been fighting that battle for a while. There was actually a bike plan for the city of Houston with the routes proposed, and I think that we put a federal application in maybe in the early 90s, but I know it's at least 15 years old. And as before we could get the elements built, before we could draw down the federal money, the situation on the ground keeps changing. But the one thing that's been constant is the fact that we want to have an extensive bike network along our biosystem. Those are the green necklace for the city.
Yes, but the bayou system is basically there for flooding. And the T.C. Jester one seems like it was built in that respect. Buffalo Bayou, it's like, well, that's an older one. And, of course, whenever it rains hard, that's flooded out.
Well, the whole bayou system is, I mean, that's our drainage, our major drainage system. But the fact that a bike trail is underwater occasionally, as long as they're structurally sound and they're not washing out, that's part of the system. It's still an integral part of connecting bikers all across the city. And I'm glad that Buffalo Bio was saved and preserved, and we didn't channelize it the way we did with a lot of our other bios, that it's still a natural setting. But if you drive along Buffalo Bio and you see how the bio opens out, and those nice little low areas, in fact, the informal dog park that we have down there at Montrose, Those are catch basins. They fill up with water.
Is running for city controller after being city council at large for 6 years, or just about 6 years as her term ends. Anise was president of the Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus in years past, been part of this neighborhood for a number of years. And you also worked in community areas, community associations. And there sometimes is, probably more than sometimes, different thoughts on this is a city without zoning, and you've got so many different interests here. You've got neighborhood interests, you've got business interests, and you've got interests of renters who may not have a voice anywhere. How do you try to work together with all these different elements?
A lot of what government is balancing competing interests, legitimate competing interests. For example, we have been dealing with an issue down in City Hall about Memorial Park and whether to create a master plan for Memorial Park. Memorial has large undeveloped tracks that have bike trails and walking trails and jogging trails, and it has wildlife. It also has a golf course and a tennis center and baseball fields and soccer fields and so forth. It's a jewel of a park. We have compare Memorial Park to Herman Park, which is a completely urban park. You can get out among the trees and enjoy the sunshine, but you're not going to enjoy nature there. And so we're engaged in a debate on what should the future be for Memorial Park. And there are not enough softball fields and baseball diamonds and soccer fields and tennis courts in the city. So you don't want to displace the people who are desperate for those services, but wild areas in the city are irreplaceable. So what do you do? We're trying to balance those interests.
And this is also a city where there's a high percentage of people who are overweight, as you know, has been quoted by some national magazines.
Because we have the best restaurants here.
And we have the best restaurants. But see, we're also an outdoor city, and we need to get people, we could be an outdoor city, we need to get people out and about and moving around. And more Houstonians are becoming concerned about the quality of life here. And I don't know whether part of that is a lot of new people moving in and they're used to things in their home cities, whether it's mass transit or sidewalk cafes or the fact that they can live in a house and not have a car repair shop open up next door. That's the zoning issue. They want certain things out of the city, and they expect us to provide it. And we have a different mindset now. It's not all about developers' rule or that money is the only thing that matters.
How is Houston competing against other cities to bring the jobs back here? And I know the controller may not have a direct response to, you know, be able to do anything on that, but serving as city council, working with the mayor and the city government?
They're the things that you do just in having a city with a good infrastructure and a quality of life. And things like the stadiums were sold to us on the basis of, you know, these are things that we have to have in order to compete for people to live here. But what draws people here, jobs, low cost of living, and amenities. Well, jobs and low cost of living draw people here. What keeps people here, I should say, is a quality environment. We have to deal better with our air quality. We have to provide the parks and the libraries and the restaurants and the ambiance that makes this a good place to live. Or folks will come, they'll spend a few years on the job, and they'll look for opportunities to transfer out again. What the city does is we focus on those quality of life issues, and that's been a big part of what I've done on council. But we also offer companies tax abatements for relocating here. We try to provide incentives for or opportunities for moving around the city, mass transit, carpooling. They're just different things that and the same thing that attracts, like, you know, I think I'm starting to ramble here. It's been a long day, but the same thing that attracts people here, that low cost of living, the jobs. We have a large employment base here, and we're investing very heavily in our educational infrastructure. You know, there's a HCC bond election coming up. But Houston has a number of four-year universities. It has a very extensive network of community colleges, and we're spending a lot of money to upgrade that educational base. We have so cheap labor, cheap cost of living, and an educated labor force. It's increasingly an educated labor force, and we're using that to lure folks here.
There was a survey, or somebody wrote up an article about people of our community, GLBT people, and the fact that Jacksonville will probably never be a big city on the map for people to move to because it's so conservative and there's so many obstacles to do that. And certainly we've seen the history of some of the major corporations now have non-discrimination policies, and some of them even having domestic partnerships, which I thought we would never see, being that these were these sort of redneck oil companies, but even they had learned. Unfortunately, we've gone through the election of 84 and then a 2001, which we lost closely, but we still lost a vote affirming non-discrimination in city employment by the public.
I think that 2 years ago, it was a little bit of the perfect storm element in that. We had a very conservative candidate for mayor working closely with the anti-domestic partner benefits folks, and they created a synergy and brought people to the polls who would not have come out otherwise, and the two together were much stronger than either one individually. I think the domestic partners issue brought out a lot of folks who voted for Mr. Sanchez, and Mr. Sanchez brought out folks who voted for the other, and it was a narrow loss, and we're winning those fights around the country. But I don't think that vote truly reflects either the population of Houston, which I'm proud to say has elected me three times, and I hope a fourth time. But it's also we're filled with employers who offer these kind of benefits. We're still somewhere between the South and the Southwest. We're an unusual city. We have our conservative elements, but this has been a city that's very open and has been very nurturing to a lot of us. And I think that vote, while it was disappointing, is not reflective of the city as a whole. And a handful of years, you could go back out and take that vote again and win it easily.
Great. Early voting continues to Friday, and if you want the endorsement list of the Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, you can go to our website, queervoices.org, and find it, or go to their website, which is hglpc.org, and it's on there. And the the election is a week from tomorrow, and the polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And you can also go to our website to find out the information from the county on where you can vote. And early voting is an incredible thing that we have here in Texas, and we should be really proud of it. It gives you the opportunity to vote and not worry about it election day if you get caught up at work or in traffic or something like that. Anise, are you still looking for some volunteers?
Oh, I'm absolutely looking for volunteers. And if anyone's interested in my campaign, if I may give the phone number for the campaign, 713-807-9100. 807-9100. The headquarters is over in the Woodland Heights area, 45 in North Main. But whether it's my campaign or any of the other campaigns, I would say, please go vote. Please go vote early. Don't wait until next Tuesday. Go over this week and cast your ballot. But if you don't know anything about the candidates, take the time to find an organization you trust and get a slate card, whether it's the LPC or the Houston Chronicle. Just, there are...
Which, of course, you're endorsed by both of them.
I'm endorsed by both of them, so I can happily say that. And the Jewish Herald Voice, and I can name off a number of other ones. But I've been blessed with endorsements this year. But there are enemies of our community who are on the ballot. And there are people who probably ought to be institutionalized out there who are on the ballot. Doesn't take a lot of money to get on a ballot and run for office. Do not vote blindly.
And of course, KPFT is a nonprofit organization, a 501c3, and KPFT does not endorse. This is just basically public information and talk about some of the issues that are of concern of our community and the city at large. The best of luck, Anise. You're listening to Queer Voices.
And I think JD has a piece of music that he wants to introduce.
Yes, thanks, Glenn. On my Queer Music Heritage show last February, I featured Queer Jazz, the music of gay and lesbian jazz artists, and one of the artists who I had the pleasure of interviewing was Mary Lofstrom. In June, she went on to win the App Music Award for Outstanding Female Recording for her album Ginger Comes to Stay. And I talked to her on the phone after that win in June, and she shared with me that she was suffering from scleroderma and ovarian cancer. And sadly, last Monday, she died. She was in a hospice. She was 38. So I'd like to offer one of my favorite of her songs as kind of a tribute. It's called Ginger. It's from Ginger Comes to Stay. You can find out about her at www.marylofstrom.com. Glenn?
In the hush of dawn, someone I adore waits for me. Waiting to be, wanting for we, sweet, sweet.
memoriam to Mary Lofstrom from the album Ginger Comes to Stay. That was cut number 4, Ginger. You're listening to Queer Voices and looking at the news. Two preachers known for their anti-gay rhetoric in Florida and Pennsylvania have been arrested for soliciting sex with boys under the age of 16. According to the Broward Sheriff's Office in Florida, 46-year-old Reverend Hewitt Lee Bennett was arrested when a resident of a North Lauderdale neighborhood reported a suspicious person prowling the area. Police say Bennett, a volunteer assistant youth minister and elder at the West Palm Beach First Seventh-day Adventist Church, told them that he was in the area to talk to young people about coming to the Lord. Police reported seeing a 15-year-old boy walking away from Bennett's car. The boy told them that Bennett had asked for directions to his house and demanded that he get in the car. Well, the boy said he gave them a fake address and ran away. The boy later told investigators that he had communicated with Bennett in a gay chat room where Bennett allegedly said that he, quote, wanted to come over and have anal sex and teach the boy about different sexual positions. Police say Bennett admitted that he had talked with children about sex online, but had only described sex acts to gain their trust and to tell them about the love of Jesus. Bennett was arrested and charged with using a computer service to seduce, solicit, lure, or entice a child to commit an illegal sex act. Bennett, who is married and the father of three children, was released from jail after posting $1,000 as bail money. No trial date has been set. Meanwhile, a Pennsylvania preacher who spent years using a bullhorn to rail at passersby on college campuses about fornicators, whores, and sodomites was arraigned Thursday after being accused by a 14-year-old of soliciting a sex act. Reverend Stephen White, a 40-year-old preacher at the University of Pennsylvania and various local churches, is known in the area for traveling to college campuses and giving fire and brimstone speeches against homosexuality. According to court documents, White approached an unidentified teen boy and asked if he knew of any adult shops in the area selling pornographic video or magazines. After the boy told him that he did not, White told the boy that he could make some money by letting White perform oral sex on him. Afterwards, the boy fled White and reported the van's license plate number to his mother, who then contacted the police. Campus Crusade for Christ, an umbrella organization for Christian students at Penn State, disavowed any affiliation with White, who also goes by the name Brother Stephen. Campus Crusade leader Erin Hespy told news authorities that her organization does not support White. Quote, Brother Stephen is not involved or affiliated with any of the student Christian groups listed on Penn for Jesus. The general attitude of these Christian groups has been one of distance, Hespy said. White is charged with a criminal attempt to lure a child into a motor vehicle and criminal solicitation to involuntary deviant sexual intercourse. His trial is set for November 14th. And again, that's the case of a couple of anti-gay preachers who were arrested this week for, guess what, soliciting sex with boys. You're listening to Queer Voices.
I don't know whether there's anyone in the audience that saw a performance of Don Juan in Hell. But as Charles Laughton and Charles Boyer and Cecilia Parker and I toured for 4 years in a play called Don Juan in Hell, which is the dream sequence of Man of Superman. It is seldom played together because Don Juan in Hell is a full-length play, and so is Man of Superman. In that play, and this is, if you want to read it again, is the basic philosophy of Shaw, and if you understand that, you understand his philosophy, you understand really all of Shaw's plays, because there's always this philosophy that runs through it, through every play. There are so many wonderful speeches in that play, and I think sometimes audiences have a great deal of difficulty following it because maybe something great that they want to remember and suddenly it is gone and there's another great speech and it goes very quickly. There is a speech that I think is very pertinent to the times. It is the devil's speech on destruction. and I'd like to do it for you tonight. Charles Laughton played the role of the devil. Charles Boyer played the role of Don Juan. Sir Cedric Hardwicke played the statue, might be the epitome of all women. It is a play of argumentation, and it is. And if you remember Dorothy Brevin, you know that there was a great argument between the devil and Don Juan. Don Juan says, what the world needs is a Superman with a super brain. And the devil retaliates with, and is man any the less destroying himself for all this boasted brain of his? Have you walked up and down upon the earth lately? I have. And I have examined man's wonderful inventions. And I tell you that in the arts of life, man invents nothing. But in the arts of death, he outdoes nature herself and produces by chemistry and machinery all the slaughter of plague, pestilence, and famine. The peasant I tempt today eats and drinks what was eaten and drunk at the fence of 10,000 years ago. And the house he lives in has not altered as much in 1,000 centuries as the fashion of a lady's bonnet in a score of weeks. But when he goes out to slay, he carries a marvel of mechanism that lets loose at the touch of his fingers all the hidden molecular energies and leaves the javelin, the arrow, and the blowpipe of his fathers far behind. In the arts of peace, man is a bungler. I've seen his cotton factories and the like with machinery that a greedy dog could have invented if it wanted money instead of food. I know his clumsy typewriters, his bungling locomotives, and his tedious bicycles. They are toys compared with the nuclear gun, the submarine torpedo boat. There is nothing in man's industrial machinery but his greed and sloth. His heart is in his web. This marvelous force of life of which you boast is a force of death. Man measures his strength by his destructiveness. What is his religion? An excuse for hating me. What is his law? An excuse for hanging you. What is morality? Gentility, an excuse for consuming without producing. What is his art? An excuse for gloating over pictures of slaughter. What is politics? Either the worship of a despot because a despot can kill, or parliamentary cockfighting. I spent an evening lately in a certain celebrated legislature and heard the pot lecturing the kettle for its blackness and ministers answering questions. When I left, I chopped upon the door, the old nursery saying, ask no questions and you'll be told no lies. I bought a family magazine and found it full of pictures of young men shooting and stabbing one another. I saw a man die. He was a London bricklayer's laborer with 7 children. He left £17. And his wife spent it all on his funeral and went into the workhouse with the children the next day. She wouldn't have spent 7 pence on her children's schooling. The law had to force her to let them be taught gratuitously, but on death, she spent all she had. Their imagination glows. Their energies rise up at the thought of death. These people, they got it. And the more horrible it is, the more they enjoy it. Hell is a place far beyond their comprehension. They derived their notion of it from 2 of the greatest fools that ever lived. An Italian and an Englishman. The Italian described it as a place of mud, frost, filth, fire, venomous serpents, all torture. This ass, when he was not lying about me, was moaning about some woman whom he once saw on the streets. The Englishman described me as being expelled from heaven with cannons and gunpowder. And to this very day, every Briton believes that the whole of his silly story is in the Bible. What else he says, I do not know. For it's all in a long poem which neither I nor anyone else ever succeeded in wading through. The same in everything. The highest form of literature is in its tragedy. A play in which everyone gets murdered in it. In the old chronicles we read of plagues and earthquakes and pestilences and famine. And are told that these show the power and majesty of God and the littleness of man. Nowadays, the chronicles describe that. In a battle, 2 bodies of men shooting one another with bullets and explosive shells until one body runs away from the other, chases the fugitives on horseback and cuts them to pieces as they fly. And this, the chronicle concludes, shows the greatness and majesty of empire. and the littleness of the vanquished. Over such battles, the people run about the streets yelling with delight and egg their governments on to spend hundreds of millions of money in the slaughter, while the strongest minister dare not spend an extra penny in the pound against the poverty and pestilence through which they themselves daily walk. Oh, I could give you a thousand instances, but they all come to the same thing. The power that governs the earth is not the power of life, but of death. And the enemy which has served life to the organization of the enemy to serve life as a human being is not the need for higher life, but for a more efficient engine of destruction. The earthquake, famine were too spasmodic in their action. The tiger, the crocodile, too easily satiated, not cruel enough. Something more constantly, more ruthlessly, more ingeniously destructive was needed. And that something was bad. The inventor of the rack, the stake, the gallows, the electric chair, a sword, and gun, and poison gas. Above all, of justice, duty, patriotism, and all the other isms by which even those who are humanely disposed are persuaded to become the most destructive of all the destroyed. Pretty devilish speech, don't you think?
Okay, Joan, you promised to explain what all that was about.
You didn't listen. No, actually, that is Agnes Moorehead. She was doing The Devil's Speech on Destruction, which is from Man and Superman, which was written by George Bernard Shaw. And it's basically a thesis on how we are the best at destroying each other. That is where we put most of our time and energy as people. And given what we're dealing with the war in Iraq and other things that are going on under the current regime, I thought it was rather appropriate.
Interesting. How did you get that on the air?
I put it on there when you were talking to Anise.
Oh, you snuck around me.
Wasn't she a lesbian, though?
That's true.
There's a tie in there, Jack.
Jack just likes to give me a hard time.
Speaking of good writing articles, which, and speaking of persons who can't speak very well.
Speaking of loose transitions.
Yes, very loose. In Sunday's New York Times, Frank Rich usually writes a column on the front page of the arts and leisure section, and he was comparing the current stuff as Vietnam, you know, revisited in a sense of what's going on. And it's sort of interesting. He always writes some very good stuff, and I can't figure out why he's on the arts and leisure page and not on the op-ed section.
Well, you know, 30 people were killed today in suicide bombs.
Yeah, it's pretty sad, and there were some big protesters in San Francisco, in Washington over the past weekend. But that's usually covered on a bunch of other shows rather than ours. But certainly our community is concerned about that because, you know, this big check for $87 billion is going other places than some of the issues that need to be dealt with here.
All right.
I noticed in the PFLAG newsletter that J.D. just pulled out that Angels in America is going to be performed at the HSVPA school, which is sort of like the FAME school here in Houston. Sounds pretty interesting. I think we'll probably check into that.
Yeah, we'll call over there. They've been on before, so I'm sure they'll be happy to come on and tell us what they're doing and how we can see it
That's quite an ambitious production.
Yeah, yes. For high school students, it's amazing.
Yes, I saw it. It's very impressive. I saw it at the alley.
I saw one of the two. I didn't see both of them. Also, David Sedaris was in town on Friday. I didn't get to see him.
Right.
It would have been interesting. Of course, he doesn't usually do local radio anymore because he's on NPR.
Because he's all famous now.
Yes, right.
Well, I read a book by J.D.'s friend, Matt Bernstein Sycamore. And I guess you met him when you were in Los Angeles.
I met him in L.A. at a book reading at Different Light bookstore.
Yeah, Different Light is wonderful.
And tipped him off and said, get your book to Joan.
Well, the review is in the Triangle this week, and he will be on our show here probably within the next several weeks. And it is a very, very good book, a little bit disturbing, but that's on purpose. And
Kind of biographical,
and I highly recommend it. It's called Pulling Taffy, and it's his very first work.
What's his name again?
Matthew Bernstein Sycamore.
Well, speaking of high arts, next week, J.D., you're going to have an interesting interview.
This is a step up. This is going to be a challenge because we're going to have an opera devo, not diva, a devo named David Daniels, who's getting quite a name for himself around the country in both the gay press and the mainstream press, because he's a very noted countertenor, which is a very high opera voice. He's been doing a lot of the roles that were originally written for men to do back in the 17th century whenever these were written, but they haven't traditionally been done that way because the parts are too high. But he's able to do it because he's got that kind of voice. So he's been making some news doing that. He's openly gay. He's going to be appearing at the Houston Grand Opera, which is why he's in town, and he's going to be our live guest next week. So this will be neat. Besides having several opera CDs out, he has a brand new CD that it's more traditional music, but it's done sort of classical style. It's very interesting. I like it quite a bit.
Sounds interesting. And yeah, and of course, next week is the first week of the month, so David Elliott will be on. And Pat Gandy is going to be on talking about LIH and their health fair. And
that's right. That's coming up on the 8th of November, the Lesbian Health Initiative Health Fair. It's going to be a very spectacular event. And this is a means for providing health care for women who may not have been able to get it any other way.
And she's probably also going to sneak in a few little things about Dean for president.
That's okay.
I can't imagine Pat not being a little bit political.
And the election is coming up in November, and I'm sure you're going to say something about that next week.
Well, yes, we'll talk about that. We'll be talking about it this week. And, in fact, early voting goes on until Friday. And you can check our website that will link you to the Harris County Voter Information site. And you can also go to our website and check out the endorsement list of the Houston Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. And, of course, we are talking to Anise Parker today, and she's running for controller.
What is our website again, Jack?
Queervoices.org.
Thank you.
Just like the name of the show. It also links to JD's website, which is queermusicheritage.com.
Thank you. Yes, it does.
And I think we have time for one news item.
Okay.
The first openly gay Episcopalian bishop-elect is now under 24-hour FBI protection because of death threats against him. Reverend Gene Robinson told a conference of gay priests this weekend that he has received death threats from fundamentalist Christians and had grave concerns for his safety. Quote, "We are doing what we need to do to keep me safe so that I can try to keep making the witness that I'm trying to make," Robinson said. "The standing committee of the diocese is taking this very seriously, as is the bishop," he said. Robinson spoke via satellite to the gathering in Manchester, England. The FBI warned him against attending the conference because of threats to his safety, he said. Conference attendees applauded when Robinson said that the diocese wants a bishop, not a martyr. Robinson said that he had received hate mail, including a postcard from England, describing him as, quote, "a fornicating, lecherous pig." "The fact of the matter," he said, "is that I am neither the devil one side would take me nor the saint the others would have me to be." Laura Montgomery Rutt, media coordinator for Soul Force, a non-denominational advocacy group for GLBT Christians, told the Gay.com Planet Out Network that the opposition to Robinson and the threats against him stem from, guess who, conservative Christians and their fears. Quote, "They are afraid of change in the church, change in society, and change in accepting the worth and dignity of GLBT people," she
said. Talking to the Pope.
Mm-hmm. "And that fear fuels this kind of violence. Every religion has extremists in it, and the people issuing threats to Bishop Robinson are certainly extremists," Rutt said, "but they do not represent the majority of evangelical Christians struggling with this issue. Despite threats from conservative bishops around the world that Robinson's consecration will cause a permanent and irreparable split in the Anglican Communion, just like they said about women priests, Robinson pledged this weekend to proceed with the ceremony on November 2nd. The only thing that will stop this happening is if I am not around anymore," he told the London Independent. "We have to take that seriously," he said. Well, if a schism does occur in the United States between liberal and conservative Episcopalian factions, some bishops are worried that conservative church officials may attempt to seize the property of liberal churches. One liberal Pennsylvania bishop sued on Friday to prevent such a move. The Reverend Harold Lewis and the Calvary Episcopal Church filed the suit, which does not seek damages, but instead insists that dioceses comply with the church's constitution and bylaws regarding property. Lewis contends that those bylaws prevent churches that split from the Episcopal Church USA from taking property with them. "And the suit has nothing to do with Gene Robinson," Lewis told the Associated Press, "and it's nothing about homosexuality," he said. "This is just about the Episcopal Church."
Hey, you're listening to KPFT Houston at 90.1 and 89.5 in Galveston, and of course on the web at kpft.org.
Every kiss is a revolution. 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 Every kiss is a revolution.
Welcome to Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I'm here on the fourth Monday of each month to bring you an hour to